Vimes watched the young man's face as he considered his own meagre options and found that there was no plural. "I did endeavour to properly advise the justices as to their situation, of course," he said, like a man rehearsing a plea, "but I'm sorry to say that they took the view that since they own the land hereabouts, then they decide the law of said land. I have to say that they are, in themselves, quite decent people." Vimes was surprised at how well his temper was keeping these days. He said, "Land. I quite like land. It's one of my favourite things for standing on. But land, and landlord, and law. Well, a man might get quite confused, yes? Especially in the presence of a pretty good fee. And it's quite easy for people to be jolly decent people when they can afford to hire thoroughly undecent people, people that don't even need orders, just a nod and a wink." At this point there was a roll of thunder, not really appropriate to the last comment, and therefore without occult significance. Nevertheless, it was a giant roll that trundled around the sky, dropping blocks of sound. Vimes looked up and saw a horizon the colours of a bruise, while all round him the air was calm and warm, and insects and other creatures that he couldn't guess at were buzzing in the undergrowth. Satisfied that he need not look for cover yet, he turned his attention back to the squirming lawyer. "May I suggest, Mr. Stoner, that you suddenly develop a pressing reason to go to the city, and possibly talk to some of the senior lawyers there? I suggest that you describe yourself as foolish, and when they see your damp trousers, that will act as corroboration, believe me. If necessary, I might find it in my heart to make a statement on your behalf, to the effect that I think you were silly and badly led rather than criminal." The look of gratitude read well, and so Vimes added, "Why don't you try criminal law? It's mostly grievous bodily harm and murderers these days. You could call it ointment for the soul. Just a couple of things, though. What do you know about goblins being sent down river? And what do you know about the disappearance of Jefferson the blacksmith?" It's never nice to face a difficult question when you're thinking about getting on a horse and travelling long distances at speed. "I can assure you, Your Grace," replied the man, "that I know nothing about the disappearance of the smith, if indeed he hasn't simply gone to work elsewhere. And goblins? Yes, I know that some were sent away some years ago, but I took up this post 2 years back, and I cannot comment on those circumstances." He added primly, "I have no knowledge whatsoever of any goblins being dispossessed of their accommodation lately, as the chief constable appears to believe." Turning his back so the craning crowd could not easily see what was happening, Vimes glared at him. "I congratulate you on your careful ignorance, Mr. Stoner." He then grabbed the prim lawyer by the neck and said, "Listen to me, you little shit. What you tell me may, strictly speaking, be true. But you are a bloody stupid lawyer if you haven't realised that a bunch of landowners cannot decide all by themselves that anything they want to do is the law. If you want to keep in with both sides, Mr. Stoner, and I imagine that you do, then you might find a moment in your busy schedule to tell your former employers that Commander Vimes knows all about them, and Commander Vimes knows what to do about them. I know who they are, Mr. Stoner, because Chief Constable Upshot has given me a list of names." He gently released the pressure and said quietly, "Very soon, this will be an unfortunate place for you, Mr. Stoner." Then, turning, so that the crowd could see, he took the bewildered lawyer's hand, shook it lavishly, and said loudly, "Thank you very much for such valuable information, sir. It'll make my investigations a whole lot simpler, I can tell you. And I'm sure that Chief Constable Upshot will feel exactly the same way. It would be a much easier life for all of us if other upstanding folk were so quick to assist the police with their inquiries." He looked at the stricken lawyer and said more quietly, "I am no judge, but some of those men have a certain look about them. I know the sort, probably got more teeth than brain cells. And now, Mr. Lawyer, they're wondering how much you know and how much you've told me. I wouldn't stop to pack if I was you, and I hope you've got a fast horse." The lawyer left at speed, and, at a meaningful nod from Feeney, so did the mob, more or less evaporating into the scenery. And Vimes thought, another one snookered. Get the reds, get the colours, but sooner or later you're after the black. And now he was left with the company of only Willikins and the chief constable, who looked around like someone realising that he might not only have bitten off more than he could chew, but also more than he could lift. He straightened up when he saw Vimes looking at him. It was time for a little reinforcement, so Vimes walked over and slapped the lad on the back. "Well, I don't know, I'm sure. Well done, Chief Constable Upshot. And this time I'm not laughing at you, Feeney. I'm not making fun. I'm not talking you down. And I cannot believe that you are the lad I met only a few days ago. You stood up to them right enough. A bunch of dangerous idiots. With a lawyer. They shot an arrow at my old mum. Oh, they said they didn't, because they was hoping to frighten us off. They said they had no arrows. So I said, quick as a wink, well, you wouldn't have any arrows now if you'd shot them at my old mum, would you? So that proves it, I told them. I said, that's logic, and I didn't know what to say. Well, I'm at a loss for words myself, Feeney, because it seems to me that I heard you say some more goblins were sent downriver yesterday. How did you find that out? Feeney waved a thumb in the direction of the lock-up and grinned. Here's the key, sir. Just you go and talk to our prisoner. You'll love it, sir. He was beside himself when he knew they were coming for him, and he sang like a nightingale, didn't he, just?
Generally, we say they sing like a canary, said Vimes, turning towards the stubby little building.
Yes, sir, but this is a rural police station, sir, and I know my birds, sir, and he sang like a nightingale, right enough. A beautiful, watery cadence, sir, second only to the trill of the robin, in my opinion, possibly occasioned by his being really, really scared, sir. I'll have to slosh a bucket in there in a minute.
Well done again, Feeney. Might I suggest at this time that you go in and see your old mum? She'll be worried about you. Old mums do worry, you know.
Wee Mad Arthur was impressed. Why hadn't anybody told him about the cross step before? Well, it was only recently that he had learned that he was, by birth, a Knack Mac Feagle, instead of, as he had been given to understand, the child of peaceful shoemaking gnomes. Feagles did not wear shoes, and neither were they peaceful. Like many people before and after, Wee Mad Arthur had always thought that he was in the wrong life. When the truth had fortuitously been uncovered, it all seemed to make sense. He could be proud of being a Knack Mac Feagle, albeit one who enjoyed the occasional visit to the ballet and could read a menu in Quermion, and for that matter, read at all. He cruised above the warm blue skies of Hawanderland in great circles and enjoying himself no end. The whole continent. There were people on it, so he understood, but mostly what he was seeing from the air was either desert, mountain, or, most of all, green jungle. He allowed the albatross to drift on the thermals as his keen eyes searched for what he suspected might be there. It was, in fact, not a thing as such, but a concept, rectangular. People who planted things liked rectangular. It was orderly. It made things easy. And there it was, right down there on the coast, definitely rectangular and quite a lot of it. After a brief meal of hard-boiled egg, he persuaded the bird to perch in a treetop. Jumping to the ground was no fearsome undertaking for one of the feagle stock. As evening began to fall, Wee Mad Arthur walked through line after line of fragrant tobacco plants, but also noticeably rectangular in this land where geometry was rare, were the sheds visible not far away. He moved stealthily to begin with, and increasingly more stealthily when he saw the pile, white and complex, in the gloaming. The whiteness consisted of bones, small bones, not feagle, but far too small for human, and then, when he investigated further, he saw the corpses. One of them was still moving, more or less. Wee Mad Arthur recognised a goblin when he saw one. There were enough people who did not like feagles for feagles not to be too snotty on the subject of goblins. They were a damn nuisance, but even feagles would be happy to agree that so were they themselves. And being a nuisance is not something you should die of. In short, Wee Mad Arthur recognised this situation as very bad. He took a look at the one who was moving. There were wounds all over it. One leg was twisted back on itself, and suppurating scars covered its body. Wee Mad Arthur knew death when he saw it, and that was in the air right now. He looked at the pleading in the goblin's one remaining eye, took out his knife, and ended its suffering. While he was staring at this, a voice behind him said,
"Where the hell did you escape from?"
Wee Mad Arthur pointed to his badge, which on the hem was the size of a shield, and said,
"Thank Mopark City Watcher, Ken."
The burly human stared at him and said,
"There ain't no law here, whatever you are, you little squirt."
As Commander Vimes always said in his occasional rousing speeches to his men, it was the mark of a good officer if he or she is able to improvise in unfamiliar circumstances. Wee Mad Arthur recalled the words very clearly. "Nobody expects you to be a first-class lawyer," Vimes had said, "but if you have evidence that suggests that your proposed action is, on the face of it, justified, then you should take it." And then Wee Mad Arthur, ticking off points in his head, thought, "Slavery is illegal.
I know it used to be done, but I don't know anywhere it's done any more. The dwarfs don't do it, and neither do the trolls, and I know that Lord Vetinari is dead against it. He checked all this again to make certain that he'd got it right, and then looked up at the scowling human and said, "Excuse me, sir, what was that you just said to me?" The man smiled horribly, grasping the handle of his whip.
"I said, there ain't no law here, you rabid little skunk."
There was a pause, and Wee Mad Arthur glanced down at the dead goblin on the stinking, bone-filled mitten.
"Guess again," he said.
As battles go, it was one of the most one-sided, and that side belonged to Wee Mad Arthur. There were only a dozen or so guards on the plantation, because starving creatures in chains do not, as a rule, fight back. And they never knew who they were fighting. It was some kind of force that sped backwards and forwards across the ground, and then up your trouser leg, leaving you in no heart whatsoever for fighting, or, for that matter, anything else. Punches came out of nowhere. Those who ran were tripped, those who didn't were left unconscious. It was, of course, an unfair fight. It generally is if you are fighting even one knack-mack feagle, even if you are a platoon. Afterwards, Wee Mad Arthur found chains in some of the huts and carefully chained every recumbent guard. Only then did he open the other huts. The iron door of the lock-up slammed against the stone as Vimes entered. Nevertheless, he was taking care where he placed his feet. And Mr. Flutter sang. He certainly sang. Vimes was in no ornithological position to judge the singing in terms of nightingale or robin equivalent, but even if he had sung like a frog, it would not have mattered, because he sang about a moocher called Benny No-Nose, who hung about, as such men do, in the hope of picking up unconsidered trifles, and had traded a pair of boots. "I don't know where they came from, and no more do you, okay?" for a turkey the very evening before the nightmare began for Ted. "Well, sir," Flutter told him, "you asked me about what happened years ago, see, and what with one thing and another, what might have happened yesterday didn't cross my mind, if you see what I mean. It was all so sudden-like. Anyway, yeah, he said they'd coupled a tender behind a two oxen riverboat that very afternoon, and it smelled to him like goblins, him living near their cave in Overhang, and you never forget that smell, or so he said to the dockmaster, a man known to one and all as Wobbly No-Name, on account of him often walking funny when the drink is on him, and was told, yeah, they're sending him down while the going is good, and he never saw them and neither did I, understand? Someone must think it very important, because Stratford is on the boat. Someone must have stamped their foot about that, because Stratford, well, he don't like boats. Don't like water, come to that. Won't travel on the boat at all if he can help it." Vimes didn't whoop. He didn't even smile. He hoped you made sure you didn't if you could help it, but he gave himself a point for being civil to Flutter. You couldn't get off feagle-free after a charge of accessory to murder, but there were ways and ways of doing time, and if this all worked out as he hoped it would, Flutter might find that time would pass comfortably, and even perhaps faster than usual. He said, "Well, thank you, Ted, I'll look into it. In the meantime, I'll leave you in the capable hands of Chief Constable Upshot, to whom a prisoner is as sacred as his dear old mum, trust me." He pulled out the key to let himself out, and then paused, as if an important point had just aimlessly struck him. "A two-oxen boat? Does that go twice as fast?" And now Flutter was a riverboat expert. "Not really, but you can pull more load even through the night, see? Now your one-ox boat has to stop overnight at cattle landing, so as the beast can have its rations and a jolly good chew, and some shut-eye before dawn, and there's cost in time and money right there." Prisoner or not, Ted was now a self-styled lecturer to the unfortunately ignorant. "But with two oxen, well, one can be taking a bit of a rest while the other is keeping the boat moving. I reckon there were three or four barges behind that one. Not too much for one ox downstream at this time of year," he sniffed. "I wanted to be an ox boat pilot, but of course the bloody Zunes have got it sewn up." A race of freshwater mariners found everywhere in and around the Stowe Plains. They are said to be incapable of lying, although this piece of information has been provided by the Zunes themselves, causing, as it were, a philosophical conundrum. Certainly, it is maintained that they find the concept of a lie so difficult to understand that the few among them who have mastered the technique are venerated and given high office in Zune society. "I did do a season on one, mucking out and feeding, but I prefer turkeys." "And the name of the boat?" said Vimes carefully. "Oh, everybody knows it. It's the biggest on the river. Everybody knows the wonderful Fanny." Internal monologues can play themselves out quite fast, and Vimes's went, "Let me think. Ah, yes, almost certainly there was a captain who had a wife who was probably named Francesca at birth. But that's too much of a mouthful, and he named his boat after her because he loved her very much.
and there you have it. There is no need to dwell on the subject, because there are only so many words, letters, and syllables available to the tongue, and if you can't come to terms with that, then you might as well never get out of bed. And so, having got his brain sorted out, he released the clamps on his silly, embarrassed face reflex and said, "Thank you for your cooperation, Ted, but if you had told us earlier, we might have been able to catch the damn boat." Flutter looked at him in astonishment. "Catch the Fanny? Bless you, sir, a man with one leg could do that. She's a bulk carrier, not a streaker. Even going all night, she won't have got much past Fender's Bend by now. There are bends all the way, you see. I reckon you never get more than half a mile without a bend. And it's full of rocks, too. Seriously. You have to zigzag so much on old treachery, you're often crossing your own wake." Vimes nodded at this. "One last thing, Ted. Remind me again. What exactly does Mr. Stratford look like?" "Oh, you know the type, sir. Sort of average. Don't know how old he is. Maybe 25? Maybe 20? Sort of mousy hair. No scars that show, amazingly." Ted looked embarrassed at this paucity of information and shrugged. "Sort of average height, sir." He scrabbled for details and gave up. "To tell you the truth, he sort of looks like everyone else, sir. That is, until he gets angry." Ted's face lit up. "And that, sir, is when he looks like Stratford." Willikins was sitting on the bench under the chestnut tree with his hands resting peacefully on his knees. He was good at it. He had a talent for resting that had escaped Vimes. It must be a servant thing, Vimes thought. If you don't have anything to do, don't do anything. And right now he could do with a rest. Maybe evidence was going downstream even as he stood there, but by the sound of it, at a speed that could almost be overtaken on foot. Regrettably, Sybil was right. At his age, you had to be sensible. You sometimes had to catch your breath while you still had some. He sat down beside the man and said, "An interesting day, Willikins." "Indeed, yes, Commander, and may I say that young Constable Upshot handled his responsibilities with great aplomb. You have a talent for inspiring people, sir, if I may say so." There was silence for a while, and then Vimes said, "Well, of course, we were helped by the fact that some bloody fool actually let an arrow go. You could see them thinking about what might happen if you're one of the gang that killed a dear old lady. That's the kind of trouble you don't get out of easily. That opened them up." "And it was obviously a real stroke of luck for us," Vimes added, without turning his head. He let the silence continue as the storm raged in the distance, while nearby whatever it was that was chirping in the bushes carried on doing so in the warm, sultry afternoon. "It puzzles me, though," he went on, as if the thought had only just crossed his mind. "If it was someone in the front of the crowd who had loosed his crossbow, then surely I would have seen it. And if it was one towards the back, then he would have to have been clever and skilful enough to sight through maybe a very narrow space. That would be very clever shooting, Willikins." Willikins was still staring placidly ahead. Vimes's sideways glance spotted no hint of moisture on his brow. Then the gentleman's gentleman said, "I expect these country lads excel at trick shooting, Commander." Vimes slapped him on the back and laughed. "Well, that's the funny thing, don't you think? I mean, did you see their gear? It was low-grade stuff, in my opinion, not well maintained. The kind of stuff that Grandad brought back from some war. Whereas that arrow, I recognise that evil little package as a custom-made bolt for the burly and strong in the arm Peacemaker Mark IX. You remember?" "I'm afraid you will have to refresh my memory, Commander." Vimes was beginning to enjoy himself and said, "Oh, you must. Only three of them were made, and two of them are still under wizard-assisted lock and key in the company vaults. And the other, surely you remember this, is locked safely in that little vault that we made in the cellar at Schoon Avenue last year. You and I poured concrete while Sybil and the lad were out, and rubbed dirt all over the floor so that you had to know it was there in order to find it. It's a hanging matter for anyone to be found with one of them, according to veterinary. And the Assassin's Guild told the Times that hanging would be a picnic compared with what would happen to anyone they found in possession of one of those. I mean, think about it. Can't hardly tell it's a crossbow. Silent, folds up and fits in a pocket in an instant, easily concealed and deadly in the hands of a skilled man such as you or I." Vimes laughed again. "Don't be surprised, Willikins. I recall your prowess with even a standard military bow during the war. Heavens know what someone like you could manage with the damn Peacemaker. I just wonder how one turned up out here in the country. After all, Feeney confiscated all the weapons he found, but maybe one of the chaps had hidden it in his boot. What do you think?" Willikins cleared his throat. "Well, Commander, if I may speak freely, I might surmise that there are many workers at Burley and Strong in the Arm, which is one factor, and of course the directors of the most famous weapons producer on the plains might also have decided to hide away a few souvenirs before the range was banned, and who knows where they might have got to. I can think of no other explanation. Well, of course you may be right, said Vimes. And while it's a terrifying thought that one of these things might be out on the streets somewhere, I must admit that the idiot who used it really helped us out of a difficult situation. He paused for a while, and then said, Have you had a pay rise lately, Willikins?
I'm entirely satisfied with my remuneration, Commander.
It is entirely deserved, but to be on the safe side, I'd like you, as soon as we are back home, to check in the cellar, just in case, will you? Because obviously, if there are more of those bloody things out there, I want to make certain that I've still got one too. And as Willikins turned away, Vimes continued, Oh, and Willikins, it's a damn good job for you that Feeney cannot put two and two together. Was that the faintest sigh of relief? Surely not.
I will expedite that as soon as we enter the building, Commander, and I am certain that should you yourself want to go down there sometime later to make a personal check, you will find it resting where it has always been.
I'm sure I shall, Willikins, but I wonder if you could solve a problem for me. I have to catch the wonderful Fanny, he added hurriedly, which is about, of course.
Yes, sir, I am aware of the vessel in question. Remember that I'd already been here for some time before you and her ladyship arrived, and I happened to be near the river when she went upstream. I recall the people pointed her out to me. I was given to understand that she was going up to Overhang to load up, probably with iron ore brought down from the dwarf mine, which rather surprised me, given that normally they smelt directly at their mines and export the bar stock, this being a more economical method, sir.
Fascinating, said Vimes, but I think that however slow it goes, I ought to get after her. Feeney was just emerging from the cottage.
I've heard about the boat, lad. We should get going while it's still light.
Feeney actually saluted.
Yes, I have that in hand, sir. But what about my prisoner? I mean, my old mum could give him his meals and empty his bucket for him. Won't be the first time she's had to do that sort of thing. But I don't like leaving her by herself right now, if you get my thinking.
Vimes nodded. Back home, he only had to snap his fingers for a watchman to become immediately available. But now, well, he had no choice.
Willikins.
Yes, Commander.
Willikins, against my better judgment, and I dare say yours, I hereby appoint you to the rank of Special Constable, and I command you to take the prisoner back to the hall and keep him under lock and key there. Even a bloody army would be mad to attack the hall with Sybil in it. But just in case, Willikins, I can think of no man better suited to guard my family.
Willikins beamed and saluted.
Yes, sir. Orders received and understood, sir. You can depend on me, sir. Well, when we get back to the city, could you please not let anyone know that I was a copper for a while? I have friends, sir, dear friends, who have known me for a long time, and they would cut my ears off if they heard I was a copper.
Well, far be it from me to whiten a man's name against his will, said Vimes. Do we have an understanding? I'd be grateful if you could refrain from too much adventurousness. Just guard the prisoner and ensure that no harm comes to him. If this means a little judicious harm has to come to someone else, I will regretfully accept the fact.
Willikins looked solemn.
Yes, sir. Fully understood, sir. My comb will not leave my pocket.
Vimes sighed.
You have a great many things in your pockets, Willikins. Ration their usage, man. And by the way, please tell Sybil and young Sam that Daddy is chasing the bad men and will see them again soon.
Feeney looked from Vimes to Willikins.
Glad that's sorted out, gentlemen, he said, and smiled nervously. Now, if you're ready, Commander, we'll just go along to the livery stable and pick up a couple of horses.
With that, he began to walk smartly down to the village, leaving Sam Vimes no alternative but to follow.
Vimes said, Horses?
Absolutely, Commander. From what I hear, we should catch up with the Fanny in an hour. To tell you the truth, we could probably outrun it, but it's best to be on the safe side, don't you think?
Feeney looked sheepish for a moment, and then added, I don't usually ride much, sir, but I'll try not to disgrace myself in front of you.
Vimes opened his mouth. Then Vimes shut his mouth, trapping the words, Lad, I'd rather ride a pig than horse, if it's all the same to you. I mean, pigs just run along, but horses? Most of the time I've got nothing against horses. Then I come down very firmly against horses, and then I'm shot up in the air again, so that once more I have nothing against horses.
but I know that in half a second the whole damn thing starts again. And yes, before you come out with the whole business of, it's all right if you rise up when they go down, let me say that has never, ever worked for me, because then I'm either above and a little behind the horse, or against the horse so firmly that I'm really glad that Sybil and I have decided to have only one child. Feeney was, however, in keen and chattering form. I expect there are a lot of horses at Combe Valley, eh, sir? And Vimes was stuck. Actually, lad, the trolls have no use for them, and the dwarfs are said to eat them, on the quiet. Gosh, that must have been a blow to a fighting man like yourself, Commander. Fighting man? Maybe, Vimes thought, at least when no alternative presents itself. But how in the seven hells did you get the idea that I'm comfortable even looking at horses? And why are we still walking towards some barn that is going to be full of the wretched things, stamping and snorting and dribbling and rolling their eyes backward like they do? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because I'm too damn scared to tell Feeney that I'm too damn scared. Pah! The story of my life. Too much of a damn coward to be a coward. Now, Feeney pushed aside a heavy wooden gate, which to Vimes's susceptible ear creaked like a fresh gallows, and he groaned as they stepped through. Yes, it was a livery stable, and it made Vimes liverish. And there they were, the inevitable hangers-on, bandy-legged, no more than one button on their coats, and a certain suggestion of rat about the nose and wishbone about the legs. You could have played croquet with them. Every one of them had a straw in his mouth, presumably because that's what they lived on. And, helplessly, Vimes was introduced to men who knew they had heard of him, very big policemen, certainly, while Feeney painted a picture of him as just the sort of man who would insist on riding the swiftest beast that they had installed in the stalls. Two evil-looking mounts were led out, and Feeney generously brought the larger over to Vimes. "There you go, sir, back in the saddle again, eh?" he said, and handed him the reins. While Feeney was negotiating the hire, Vimes felt something tug at his leg, and he looked down into the grinning face of Special Constable Stinky, who hissed, "Big trouble, fellow policeman, colleague! Big trouble for man scared of horses, damn right! Hey, horse, can smell fear! You take me, policeman! I fix! No worry! You need Stinky anyway, yes? You find frightened goblin! Panic, panic, panic! But Stinky say, shut gob goblins! This man, despite appearances, not too much of an arsehole, yes indeed!" The wretched little goblin lowered his cracked voice still further and added, so that Vimes could barely hear it, "And Stinky never ever said anything about policeman's shirt-washing man and very cross bow, hey, Mr. Vimes?" "There is no race so wretched that there is not something out there that cares for them, Mr. Vimes." The words hit Vimes like a slap in the face. Had the little bugger said that? Had Vimes really heard it? The words had dropped into the conversation as if from somewhere else, somewhere very elsewhere. He stared at Stinky, who rattled his teeth at him cheerfully, and swung himself dreadfully under the horse, just as, on the other side of the yard, the brain's trust of debating equestrian experts settled the negotiations with Feeney. The apparent boss spat on his hand, and Feeney, against all public safety procedures, spat on his hand, and then shook hands, and then money changed hands, and Vimes hoped it had washed its hands. Then, in front of Vimes, possibly to its own amazement, the horse knelt down. Vimes had only seen that in a circus, and everyone else acted as if they'd never seen it at all. Stinky had miraculously disappeared, but when incredulous eyes are watching, as the venerable philosopher Light in Weedle says, you have to do something or be considered, in the great scheme of things, a tit. And so Vimes went bow-legged, and shuffled along the horse as nonchalantly as he could, and made the strange clicking noise that he'd heard ostlers use for every command, and the horse got to its hooves, raising Vimes as gently as a cradle, to the astonishment and subsequent wild applause of the bandy-legged throng, who clapped and said things like, "Bless you, sir, you ought to get a job in the circus." And at the same time, Feeney was all admiration, unfortunately. The wind was blowing up, but there was still some daylight left, and Vimes let the constable lead the way at a gentle trot, which indeed turned out to be gentle. "Looks like rain coming in, Commander, so I reckon we'll take it a little gently until we get down past Piper's Holding, and then round by the shallows at Johnson's Neck, where we can canter round the melon plantation, and by then we should be able to see the Fanny. Is that right by you, sir?" Sam Vimes solemnly waited for a few seconds to give the impression that he had the faintest idea about the local landscape, and then said, "Well, yes, I think that should be about right, Feeney." Stinky dragged himself up the horse's mane, grinning again, and held up a large thumb, fortunately his own. Feeney gathered up the reins. "Good, sir, then I think we'd better bustle."
It took Vimes a little while to fully understand what was going on. There was Feeney on his horse, there was the statutory clicking noise, and then no Feeney, no horse, but quite a lot of dust in the distance, and the cracked voice of Stinky saying, "Hold on tight, Mr. Policeman!" And then the horizon jumped towards him. Galloping was somehow not as bad as trotting, and he managed to more or less lie on the horse and hope that somebody knew what was going on. Stinky appeared to be in charge. The track was quite wide, and they thundered along it, trailing white dust. And then suddenly they were heading downwards, while the land on Vimes's right was going up, and the river was appearing behind some trees. He knew already that it was a river that saw no point in hurrying. After all, it was made up of water, and it is generally agreed that water has memory. It knew the score. You evaporated, you floated around in the cloud until somebody organised everybody, and then you all fell down as rain. It happened all the time. There was no point in hurrying. After your first splash, you'd seen it all before. And so the river meandered. Even the Ankh was faster, and while the Ankh stank like a drain, it didn't wobble slowly backwards and forwards from one bank to the other, as old treachery did, as if uncertain about the whole water cycle business. And as the river wiggled like a snake, so did the banks, which, in accordance with the general placid and unhurried landscape, were overgrown and thick with vegetation. Nevertheless, Feeney kept up the pace, and Vimes simply clung on the basis that horses probably didn't willfully try falling into water of their own accord. He remained lying flat because increasingly low branches and tangled foliage otherwise threatened to smite him off his mount like a fly. Ah, yes, the flies. The riverside bred them by the million. He could feel them crawling over his hair until some leaf or twig spotted them off. The likelihood of spotting the wonderful boat without having one's head smacked off seemed extremely little. And yet here, suddenly, was a respite for Vimes's aching backside, the sandbar with a few logs marooned on it, and Feeney just reining his horse to a stop. Vimes managed to get upright again, just in time. And both men slid to the ground. "Very well done, Commander. You were born in the saddle, obviously. Good news. Can you smell that?" Vimes sniffed, giving himself a noseful of flies and a very heavy stink of cattle dung. "Hangs in the air, don't it?" said Feeney. "That's the smell of a two-ox boat, right enough. They muck out as they go, you know." Vimes looked at the turgid water. "I'm not surprised. Perhaps," he thought, "this might be the time to have a little discussion with the kid." He cleared his throat and looked blankly at the mud as he got his thoughts in order. A little trickle of water dribbled over the bar, and the horses shifted uneasily. "Feeney, I don't know what we'll be getting into when we catch up with the boat, understand? I don't know if we can turn it round, or get the goblins out and then get them home over land, or if we'll even have to ride it down all the way to the coast, but I'm in charge, do you understand? I'm in charge because I'm very used to people not wanting to see me in front of them, or even alive." "Yes, sir," Feeney began, "but I think," Vimes ploughed on, "I don't know what we're going to find, but I suspect that people who try to take over boats, even a floating dung machine like the Fanny, probably get treated by the crew as pirates immediately. So I'm going to give the orders, and I want you to do exactly what I tell you, okay?" For a while it looked as though Feeney was going to object, and then he simply nodded, patted his horse and waited, while another tiny wave splashed beside the horses. The sudden silence of someone normally so talkative disconcerted Vimes, and he said, "Are you waiting for something, Feeney?" Feeney nodded and said, "I didn't wish to interrupt you, Commander, and as you say, you are in charge, but I was waiting until you said something I wanted to hear." "Oh, yes, such as?" "Well, sir, to begin with, I'd like to hear you say it's time to mount up and get out of here really fast, because the water is rising and soon the alligators will wake up." Vimes looked around. One of the logs, which he had so carelessly dismissed, was extending legs. He landed on the back of his horse with the reins in his hand in little more than a second. "I'll take that order as a given, then, shall I?" shouted Feeney as he sped after Vimes. Vimes did not attempt to slow down until he judged them high enough up the bank not to be of interest to anything that lived in the water, and then waited for Feeney to catch up. "All right, Chief Constable Upshot. I'm still in charge, but I agree to respect your local knowledge. Will that satisfy you? Where is the water coming from?" It certainly was rising. When they had started out, you would have needed a ruler to be certain it was flowing at all, but now little waves were dancing after one another, and a light rain was starting to fall. "It's that storm coming up behind us," said Feeney. "But don't worry, sir. All that means is that the Fanny will tie up if it gets too strong. Then we can just climb on board." The rain was falling faster now, and Vimes said, "What happens if it decides to carry on? It's not too far off sundown, surely?"
"That won't be a problem, Commander, don't you worry," shouted Feeney, with infuriating cheeriness. "We'll stay on the trails. No water ever gets up that far. Besides, wherever she is, the Fanny will have running lights on, red ones, oil lamps, as a matter of fact. So don't worry," Feeney finished. "If she's still in the river, we'll find her, sir, one way or the other. And may I ask, sir, what your intentions are, then?"
Vimes wasn't certain, but no officer ever likes to say that. So instead, he parried with a question himself.
"Mr. Feeney, you make this river sound like a picnic. Look over there."
He pointed across the river to a spot where the water spun and gurgled, and was almost visibly rising as they stared at it.
"Oh," said Feeney, "you always get debris coming down old treachery. The only time to worry is if you get a damn slam."
Technically, the violent surge of water on old treachery was written down in technical manuals as a damn slam, D-A-M, but anyone who has experienced one learns to swear, hence the subtle change of name.
"They only happen very rarely when circumstances are right, sir, and you can be sure the captain will have the Fanny well out of any danger if one of those should happen. Besides, he can't possibly navigate the river in bad weather at night. Old treachery is full of stags and sandbars. It would be suicidal, even for a pilot as good as Mr. Sillitoe."
They rowed on in silence, except for the terrible swirling and gurgling of dark waters down in the torrent below the bank. Only a little daylight remained now, and it was a dirty orange, helped out occasionally by flashes of lightning, followed by stone-cracking thunder. In the woods on either side of the river, trees lit and occasionally burned, which was, Vimes thought, at least a help to navigation. The rain was soaking his clothing now, and so he shouted, in a voice which betrayed his belief that he would not like the answer to what he was about to ask,
"Apropos of nothing, and just to pass the time, lad, would you tell me what exactly a damn slam is?"
Feeney's voice was initially drowned by a thunder roll behind them, but on the next go he managed,
"It's an occasional phenomenon caused by a storm getting stuck in the valley and the debris of the storm getting piled up in a certain way, sir."
Stinky scrambled up from who would dare to speculate where and up onto the horse's head. He glowed with a faint blue corpse light. Vimes reached out a finger to touch him, and a tiny blue flame danced across his hand. He knew it. "Saint Ungulant's fire," he said aloud, and wished that he was in a position to use it to light his last cigar, even if it was an exhalation of the corpses of the drowned. Sometimes you just needed a little tobacco. Feeney was staring at the blue lights with an expression of such horror that Vimes hardly dared to disturb him, but he said,
"Then what happens, lad?"
Lightning, with a sense for the dramatic moment, illuminated Feeney's face as he turned.
"Well, Commander, the debris will build up and up and tangle until it's one mass, and the river is building up so much behind it that sooner or later it'll overcome the strength of the natural dam, which will plough down the river, mercilessly sweeping up or capsizing everything in its path, all the way to the sea, sir. That's why this river is called Old Treachery."
"Well, of course," said Vimes, "I'm a simple man from the city who doesn't know much about these things, but I take it that a build-up of debris which ploughs its way downriver, sweeping up or capsizing everything in its path all the way down to the sea, is generally considered to be a bad thing."
There was a long drawn-out creak behind them as another tree was hit by a flash.
"Yes, sir. You left out the word mercilessly, sir," said Feeney carefully. "I think we really should try to catch up with the Fanny as quickly as possible."
"I think you're right, lad. And right now, I suggest..."
Whatever it was that Stinky was doing, and whatever it was that Stinky actually was, the horses were already becoming skittish to the point of bolting. There was so much water in the air, and so little light left, that the difference between the river and the shore could only be judged by seeing which one you fell into. And there was solid rain now, rain that blew from every direction, including upwards, and the symphony of dark destruction was punctuated by the sound of banks slipping inexorably into the churning water. The horses were now frantic, and direction had no meaning, and nor did warmth, and the world was nothing but darkness, water, cold despair, and two red eyes. Feeney saw them first, and then Vimes picked up the smell. It was the rich, desperate smell of oxen getting really worried, and was thick enough to stink its way out of the turmoil. Amazingly, the boat was still churning the water, making progress of sorts despite the fact that its trailing flotilla of barges was jackknifing, tangling, and generally swishing across the river like the tail of an angry cat.
"Why didn't she tie up somewhere?" shouted Feeney to the storm.
It sounded like despair, but Vimes dismounted, grabbed the sticky shape of Stinky, and slapped his horse on the rump. It certainly stood a better chance by itself now than it did with him, after all. And then, for a moment, his inner eyes looked at Coombe Valley. He had nearly died that day as water poured off the valley walls and thundered through the endless caves in the limestone, smacking him against the walls, banging him on the floors and ceilings, and finally dropping him on a tiny beach of sand in utter darkness. And the darkness had been his friend, and Vimes had floated on the face of the darkness, and there he had found enlightenment growing, and understood that fear and rage could be hammered into a sword, and the desire to once again read a book to a child could be forged into a shield and armour for a ragged dying castaway, who thereafter shook hands with kings. After that, what could be frightening about rescuing goblins, and who knew how many other people from a floundering boat on a black and treacherous river in thundering, steaming darkness? He was running now along the squelching bank, water pouring down his neck. But running wasn't enough, you had to think. You thought that the pilot of the boat knew the river and knew the boat. He could have moored at any time, couldn't he? And he hadn't done so, but he clearly wasn't a fool, because even having known the river for only a few hours, Vimes could see that no fool would survive on it for more than a few journeys. It was built to be a trap for the stupid. On the other hand, if you were not stupid, then being an oxboat pilot was a pretty good gig. You'd have prestige, respect, responsibility, and a steady wage for a steady job, in addition to the envy of all the little boys on every landing stage. Sybil had told him all about them, with some enthusiasm one evening. So why, in such a decent position, would a man pilot such a valuable boat, with valuable cargo, down a river on an evening that promised annihilation around every snake-like bend when no blame could attach to mooring up for a while? Money? No, Vimes thought. They called this river Old Treachery, and surely money wasn't any good to you when you were sinking dreadfully in its muddy embrace. Besides, Vimes knew men like that. They tended to be proud, self-reliant, and impossible to bribe. He probably wouldn't jeopardize the boat, even if you held a knife to his throat. But traditionally, the family comes too. The pilot was always working from home, wasn't he? And what would a desperate pilot do then? What would he do if a knife was held to the throat of a wife or a child? What else could he do but sail on, trusting a lifetime of experience to see them all to safety? And it wouldn't be one unwelcome guest, no, because then you would try to run the boat heavily aground, while you, muscles tensed, would rely on the confusion to leap at the fallen man and strangle him with your bare hands. But that would only work if he hadn't brought along an ally. And so then you stayed at the wheel, hoping and praying, and expecting at any moment the rumble of the dam slam. Feeney was sprinting along the bank after him now, and managed to pant, "What are we going to do, sir? Seriously, what are we going to do?" Vimes ignored Feeney for a moment. Rain, boiling surf, and fallen logs were enough to contend with, but he kept his eye on the line of barges. Right now there was a rhythm as they snaked back and forth, but it was constantly interrupted by bits of driftwood, and whatever attempt at steering was happening along there in the wheelhouse. Every time the rearmost barge hit the bank, there was a moment, one precious little moment, when a man might jump aboard if that man were foolish. So he jumped, and realised that a jump would have to beget another jump, and failure to keep the rhythm would mean falling back into the torrent. But jumping onto the next barge, which was swinging and bucking in the swell, you just hoped that you didn't get a foot stuck between the two of them. Because 2 25-foot barges colliding as a sandwich with your foot in the middle would do more than just leave a bruise. But Stinky ran and jumped and pirouetted just ahead of him, and Vimes was quick enough to get the message, landing squarely on the next barge, and so, surprisingly, did Feeney, who actually laughed, although you had to be within a foot of him to hear that. "Well done, sir. We did this when I was a lad. Every boy did. The big ones were best." Vimes had got his breath back after the first two jumps. According to what Feeney had told him, the wonderful Fanny was a bulk carrier, big and slow, but it could take any load. There could be anything in these barges, he thought, but there was no smell of goblins yet, and there were 2 barges still to go, and weather that was trying to get even worse. With that thought, there was Stinky again, who apparently could come and go without ever being seen either coming or going. And he still glowed faintly. Vimes had to crouch to speak to him. "Where are they, Stinky?" The goblin farted, quite probably as a clown does, more for entertainment than relief. Clearly happy at the response, he cracked, "Number 1 barge! Easy to get to, easy to feed." Vimes eyed the distance to the barge immediately behind the Fanny. Surely there had to be some kind of walkway, some means of getting into the barges so that the crew could access the cargo. He turned again to Feeney, dripping with rain and illumined by another flash of lightning. "How many crew do you think?"
Even this close, Feeney had to shout. Probably two men, or a man and a boy, down below in what they call a cowshed, along with the engineer, and generally a loadmaster or cargo captain. Sometimes a cook, if the captain's wife doesn't want to do the job, although mostly they do, and then one or two lads learning the business and acting as general lookouts and wharf rats. Is that all? No guards? No, sir, this ain't the high seas. Two barges crashed together, sending up a plume of water that succeeded in at last filling Vimes' boots right to the top. There was no point in emptying them, but he managed to growl through the storm. I've got news for you, lad. The water's getting higher. He steeled himself for the jump onto the next erratic barge and wondered, even so, where are the people? Surely they don't all want to die. He waited and jumped again as the barge presented itself, but fell back heavily just in time to see his sword cartwheeling roguishly into the stormy water. Cursing and struggling to keep his balance, he awaited the next opportunity to narrowly survive and this time succeed. He leapt again and almost fell backwards between the crashing timbers, but balancing perilously, fell forward instead and fell on and right through a tarpaulin into an indistinct face which cried, "Please, please, don't kill me. I'm just a complicated chicken farmer. I'm not carrying any weapons. I don't even like getting chickens." Vimes had managed to land with his arms around a plump man who would have screamed again had Vimes not clamped a hand over his mouth and hissed, "This is the police, sir. Sorry for the inconvenience, sir, but who the hell are you and what is going on? Come on, there's no time to waste." He pushed the man further into the barge, and a soggy darkness and a recognisable smell told Sam Vimes that whether the frantic speaker was complicated or not, he wasn't lying about the chickens. From the clucking, feathery gloom in the wire baskets beyond, there emanated yet another smell, announcing that a large number of chickens, never the most stoical creatures at the best of times, were now very frightened. A vague silhouette demanded, "The police? Here? Pull the other leg, mate! Oh, do you think you are, bloody Commander Vimes?" The barge bucked again, and an errant egg spun out of the darkness and smacked into Vimes's face. He wiped it off, or at least spread it around a bit, and said, "Well, well, sir, are you always this lucky?" His name was False. In full, it was Praise and Salvation False, and inevitably, when you have a false name, you will insist on explaining why, even when imminent watery death is not only staring you in the eye, but also everywhere else, possibly including both your trouser legs. "You see, sir, my family originally came from Cletch, and our name was Thalassa. But of course, over a period of time, people tend to mispronounce the way they..." Vimes interrupted him, because that was a more acceptable alternative to throttling him. "Please, Mr. False, can you tell me what's been happening on the Fanny?" "Oh dear, it was terrible. It really was extremely terrible. There was shouting and yelling, and I'm sure I heard a woman screaming. And now we keep hitting the bank, or at least that's what it sounds like. And the storm, sir, it'll have us under in two shakes of a lamb's tail, I'm certain of it."
"And you didn't go forward to sea, Mr. False?" said Vimes. The man looked startled. "Commander, I breed complicated chickens, sir, extremely complicated chickens. I don't know anything about fighting. Chickens never get all that aggressive. I'm really sorry, sir, but I didn't go to sea in case I saw, sir, see? And if I saw, sir, then I'm sure people would see me, sir. And since I reasoned that they would be people who were alive after other people might possibly be dead, sir, and maybe had a responsibility for said deaths, sir, I made certain that they didn't see me, sir, if you see what I mean. Besides, I have no weapons, weak lungs, and a wooden toe, and I'm alive at the moment." In truth, Vimes thought there was an inescapable logic to all this, so he said, "Don't worry about it, Mr. False. I bet you've got enough to do with your complicated chickens. So, no weapons at all, then? I'm very sorry to disappoint you, Commander, but I'm not a strong man. It was all I could do to drag my toolbox on board." Vimes's face stayed blank. "Toolbox? You have a toolbox?" Mr. False clutched the wall again as the barge bounced off something it shouldn't have and said, "Well, yes, of course. If we manage to get off at Quirm, I've got a site that I must make ready for 100 chicken houses, and if you want the job done properly these days, then you have to do it yourself, right?" "You're telling an expert," said Vimes, as another crash sent them both staggering. "I wonder if I could take a look at this toolbox of yours." There are times in the symphony of the world when its aural kaleidoscope of crashes, thunderbolts, screams and storms suddenly merges into one great hallelujah, and the contents of the chicken farmer's innocent toolbox, which contains nothing not made of ordinary iron and steel and wood, nevertheless gleamed in the eyes of Commander Sam Vimes like the hosts of heaven. mallets, hammers, saws, oh my. There was even a large spiral awl. What could Willikins have managed with a toy like that? Hallelujah! Oh, and here was a crowbar. Vimes balanced it in his hand and felt the street rise until it touched his feet. The complicated chicken man had heard a woman screaming. Vimes spun around as the tarpaulin was pushed aside and Feeney dropped into the barge in a flurry of spray.
I know you didn't give me the signal, Commander, but I thought I'd better tell you the water is going down.
Vimes saw Mr. False close his eyes and groan, but turned back to Feeney and said,
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it, the water going down?
No, it isn't, sir, yelled Feeney. It's still raining hard and the water level is going down. And that means that upstream of us, enough broken trees and bushes and mud and other junk are piling up to make a dam which is getting bigger and bigger and growing out sideways as the water builds up behind it, sir. Can you see what I mean?
Vimes did.
Dam slam?
Feeney nodded.
Damn right. We have two choices. Would you rather die on the river or under it? What are your orders, please, sir?
Another collision shook the barge, and Vimes stared at darkness. In this terrible twilight, somebody was managing to stop this boat from foundering. A woman had screamed, and Vimes had a crowbar. Almost absent-mindedly, he reached down into the open toolbox and picked up a sledgehammer, handing it to Feeney.
There you go, lad. I know you've got your official firewood, but things might get up close and personal. Chalk it up to the dreadful algebra of necessity, and try not to hit me with it.
He heard the voice of Feeney saying, more frantically this time,
What are we going to do, Commander?
And Vimes blinked and said,
Everything.
The wind caught the tarpaulin as Vimes pulled it open, and it flapped off across the river, leaving the complicated chicken farmer living in hope and broken eggs. They pulled themselves out into the darkness, their shadows dancing to the rhythm of the lightning. How the hell was the pilot navigating in all this? Lamps up front? Surely they could do nothing on a night like this except show up the darkness. But although there was a suspicion at every bang and bounce that the Fanny was in real trouble, Vimes could hear now the splashing of the paddle wheels, like one solid, dependable theme in the cacophony, a regular, reassuring sound. It was making way. There was some order in the world, but how could the pilot manage the chaos? How could you steer when you couldn't see? Feeney had explained in a hurry, and Vimes had expressed utter disbelief even faster.
It's true, sir. He knows every bend in the river. He knows the wind. He knows how fast we're going, and there's a stopwatch and an hourglass in reserve. He takes a turn when it's time to take it. Okay, he's shaving the banks a bit with the old Fanny, but she's pretty tough.
They jumped together onto the last barge and found a hatch that was locked. However, a crowbar is a universal pass key. And there, under the hatch, were goblins, tied hand and foot, every one, and they'd been stacked like cabbages. There were hundreds of them. Overwhelmed, Vimes looked around for Stinky, who turned out to be behind them.
Okay, my friend, over to you. We'll cut them loose, certainly, but I wouldn't mind a bit of reassurance that I won't suddenly have a load of angry goblins twisting my head backwards and forwards to see which way we take it off. Understand?
Stinky, already as skinny as a skeleton, looked even thinner when he shrugged. He pointed at the groaning heaps.
Too sore, too stiff, too hungry, too.
Stinky looked closely at a goblin at the bottom of the pile and touched a flaccid hand.
Too dead to chase anyone, Mr. Policeman. Ha! But later, give food, give water, and they chase. Oh, they chase like buggery, you bet. Once I talk to them, oh, you bet. But I will say to them, policeman, him big arsehole, okay, but kind arsehole. I will say to them, you whack him, I whack you, on account that I policeman now. Special policeman Stinky.
Vimes considered that was the best valedictory he could expect in the circumstances. Just then, Feeney managed to lever the lid off a large drum, one of several rolling around on the deck. Immediately, the terrible stench in the barge doubled in intensity, and he backed away with his hands over his mouth. Stinky, on the other hand, sniffed approvingly.
Hot damn turkey gizzards! Food of the gods! Bastard murder voyage, but okay catering!
Vimes stared at him. Well, okay, he thought. He hangs around near humans, so he picks up a vocabulary. Maybe that is suspiciously clever. Perhaps Miss Beadle gave him language lessons. Or maybe he's just some occult adventurer from hell knows where, having fun at the expense of a hard-working copper. Not for the first time. Feeney was already cutting ropes, and Vimes tried to resurrect as many goblins as he could in a hurry. It was no errand for anyone with a concern for hygiene, or even a notion of what the word meant, though after an hour in a storm on old treachery, it had no meaning anyway. They staggered up and fell down again, found their way to the upended barrel of dead turkey bits, and stumbled over slippery decks to a sloshing and now half-empty water trough that Feeney had found and was filling by the simple expedient of sticking a bucket over the side. They were coming back to life. Mostly, they were coming back to life. The barge bounced off a bank again, and amid tumbling goblins, Vimes grabbed for a handhold. Half the entire barge was full of barrels which, if you sniffed anywhere near them, were certainly not full of sweet roses. He braved the rocking deck again and said, "I don't think all this is for a little voyage to the seaside, do you? There's more barrels of stinking turkey entrails than this lot of poor devils could possibly get through in a week. Someone was expecting a long journey. Good grief." The barge had smacked into something, and, by the sound of breaking glass, that something had been smashed. Feeney stood up, holding on to a rope, and, wiping Turkey Gizzard off his coat, said, "Voyage, sir, not journey, sir. You wouldn't need all this stuff if you're travelling on land. I reckon they're bound for somewhere a long way away." "Do you think it'll be a holiday of sun, sea, surf, and fun?" said Vimes. "No, sir," said Feeney, "and they wouldn't like it if it was, would they? Goblins like the dark." Vimes slapped him on the shoulder. "Okay, Chief Constable Upshot, don't hit somebody who surrenders, and, if a man drops his weapon, be a little bit wary of him until you're certain he hasn't got another one tucked away somewhere, right? If in doubt, knock 'em out. And you know how to do that. Use the old bang, suck, cling, buck on them, eh?" "Yes, sir, that's a recipe for shoe polish, sir, but I'll bear it in mind." Vimes turned to Stinky, who already looked slightly fatter than usual. "Stinky, I don't have the faintest idea what is going to happen next. I can see your chums are starting to look alive, and so you've got the chance that we all get, sink or swim, and I can't say better than that. Come on, let's go, Feeney." This close, the wonderful Fanny was now a rolling, creaking mess, half covered by flying weeds and sticks. Apart from the storm and the clanging and creaking of mechanisms, it was silent. "Okay," said Feeney quietly, "we'd better go in by the cattle door at the stern, sir, or as you would say, the back. It won't be a difficult jump. There's lots of handholds because the loadmaster has to come out here to see the barges. Can you see that double door and the little wicket gate? We go in that way. There'll likely be more cargo along the cattle ramp because a loadmaster never wastes floor space. And then we go midships." "That is to say, the middle of the ship," said Vimes. Feeney smiled. "Yes, sir, and watch out, because it's a mass of machinery. You'll see what I mean, because you're smart. Take the wrong step, and you could fall into a gear or on top of an ox. Never a happy occasion. It's noisy, smelly, and dangerous. So if there are many bandits on this boat, I wouldn't expect to find them there." "I would," Vimes thought. "Ah, Mr. Stratford is the kind of maniac who would want to keep going in suicidal circumstances. Why? So that the cargo is a long way away before anyone knows about it. And Stratford works for Lord Rust, and the Rusts believe the world belongs to them. We're taking goblins somewhere, but they want to keep them alive. Why?" The shock of another collision brought him back to the dreadful here and now, and he said, "I'd expect to find any crew here being watched like hawks in case they put a spanner in the works." "Oh, very smart, sir, very smart indeed. There has to be some light in there for safety's sake, but not much, and all behind glass because of—" Feeney hesitated, so Vimes suggested, "Fire, perhaps? I've never known an engineer who doesn't shove grease wherever he can." "Oh, it's not exactly the grease, sir. It's the beasts. The gas does build up, so it does. And if the glass breaks, well, it's regrettably spectacular. 2 years ago, the glorious Peggy was blown out in the water for just such a reason." "Do they eat the hang-suck-butts dog with turnips around here?" "No, sir. Not as far as I know. But bang-bang-duck fusion cookery is very popular on the boats, it's true. Anyway, further on you'll find the pilot's cabin, the sleeping quarters, and then the wheelhouse, which has very wide windows, which is another good reason to attack from behind." Refreshingly, it was a short leap with a good handhold at the end of it. Vimes had no worries about being heard. The deck creaked under his feet as he crept inside the wonderful Fanny and sidled towards the middle of the ship, or whatever the hell the real term for it was, but then she creaked everywhere, and all the time, and groaned too. The boat was so noisy that a sudden patch of silence might have drawn attention to itself. "And I'm looking for somebody who looks like everybody else," he thought, "right up until he looks like the vicious killer he is. Well, that seems straightforward." Vimes was vaguely aware of huge wheels spinning frantically off to either side and chains travelling overhead, and now, here, at the top of the flight of stairs, was somebody who clearly wasn't where they should have been. It was a woman, with a small girl clinging to her dress. They had been loosely tied to a creaking beam, and a small oil lamp overhead held them in the centre of its circle of light. And this was probably because there was a man sitting a little way away from them on a stool with a crossbow lying on his lap. And here was a puzzle, because a length of string had been tied to each of his legs. One length of string ran across the floor and disappeared downwards into what was, to judge by the heat, the farmyard stink and the occasional bellow of troubled ungulate, the cowshed that Vimes had just passed. The other string disappeared forwards towards the wheelhouse. The woman spotted him and immediately clasped the child to her chest and very slowly put a finger to her lips. He had to hope that the man hadn't noticed, and did not have to hope that the woman realised that he was there to rescue her, not to add to her troubles. That wasn't necessary, but he did feel better that she was a lady fast on the uptake. He held up a hand in front of Feeney, but the lad was definitely future captain material. He hadn't moved at all. Like Vimes, he had become an observer. And Vimes observed, and let the dark rise up to assess the situation in its own inimitable way. This wasn't the summoning dark, or at least he fervently hoped not. It was just his own human darkness and internal enemy, which knew his every thought, which knew that every time Commander Vimes dragged some vicious and inventive murderer to such mercy or justice as the law in its erratic wisdom determined, there was another Vimes, a ghost Vimes, whose urge to chop that creature into pieces on the spot had to be chained. This, regrettably, was harder every time, and he wondered if one day that darkness would break out and claim its heritage, and he wouldn't know. The brakes and chains and doors and locks in his head would have vanished, and he wouldn't know. Right now, as he looked at the frightened child, he feared that moment was coming closer. Possibly only the presence of Feeney was holding the darkness at bay, the dreadful urge to do the hangman out of his entitlement of a dollar for the drop, threepence for the rope, and sixpence for his beer. How easy it is to kill, yes, but not when a smart young copper who thinks you are a good guy is looking to you. At home, the watch and his family surrounded Vimes like a wall. Here the good guy was the good guy because he didn't want anyone to see him being bad. He did not want to be ashamed. He did not want to be the darkness. The bow was pointed at the two hostages, and its holder had surely been told to fire if a leg pull sounded the alarm. Would he do it? You needed to age a bit for the dark to start trickling in, although there were always one or two who were born as darkness on legs, who had killed for a pastime. Was he one? Even if he wasn't, would he panic? How light was the trigger? Could a sudden jerk set it off? Outside, the storm raged. Whether the water was going down or not didn't seem all that important, given there was so much of the damn stuff around already. The woman was watching him out of the corner of her eye. Oh well, every moment counted. Timing his steps carefully, as if a footstep would be heard in all the thunder and creaking, Vimes crept up to the unsuspecting guard, clamped both hands around his neck and jerked upwards. The arrow thudded into the ceiling. "I don't want anyone to get hurt," Vimes tried to say it in a friendly way, but went on, "If you think you can pull strings, kid, then let me tell you that you'll run out of gasp before I run out of squeeze. Chief Constable Upshot, grab that weapon and tie up this gentleman's legs. You may keep his weapon. I know you like them." He must have inadvertently decreased the pressure, for his captive said hoarsely, "I don't want to kill anybody, sir. Please. They gave me the bow and told me I was to fire as the boat stopped, or I got pulled on the ropes. Do you think I'd do that, sir? Do you really think I'd do that? I was only sitting here in case one of them came in. Please, sir, I never came along for anything like this. It's Stratford, sir. He's a total nut job, sir. A bloody killer he is." There was a crash, and the whole boat shook. Maybe the pilot's stopwatch had let him down. "What's your name, mister?" "Eddie, sir. Eddie Brassband. I'm just a water rat, sir." The man was trembling. Vimes could see his hand shaking. He turned to the woman with the child, who was being supported now by Feeney, touched his forelock and flashed his carefully secreted badge. "Madam, I'm Commander Vimes of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch. Has this man mishandled you or the little girl in any way?" The woman had barely moved. She reminded him of the younger Sybil, calm and collected and much more likely to fight than scream, but she wouldn't fight until she was ready. "It was done pretty slick, Commander, just when I was putting Grace to bed. The bastards came on as owners of some cargo and acted like decent boys until my husband said he reckoned the weather was going to get really bad. I was in the galley. I heard a lot of yelling, and then we were put down here. Personally, sir, I would deem it a favour if you killed every man jack of them, but life can't be all fun. As far as this one is concerned,
"Well, he could have been less gentlemanly, so although I'd like you to throw him into the river, I wouldn't object if you'd refused to tie a heavy weight to his leg."
Feeney laughed.
"Wouldn't need weights, ma'am. The river is having a party, and we're all guests. I'm a pretty good swimmer, and I wouldn't dare jump in what's out there."
Vimes grabbed Brass Band and stared into his eyes. After a moment he said, "No, I know a killer's eyes when I see them. That doesn't mean you ain't a pirate, though, so we're going to keep an eye on you, okay? So don't try anything. I'm trusting you. Heavens help you if I'm wrong."
Brass Band opened his mouth to speak, but Vimes added quickly, "You could make your life a little easier, and possibly longer, Mr. Brass Band, if you were to tell me how many of your jolly parcel of rogues there are on the Fanny."
"Don't know, sir. Don't know who's still alive, see?"
Vimes looked at the woman as the boat gave a lurch. It was a strange sensation. For a moment, Vimes felt almost weightless, and there was a commotion behind them in the cowshed among the great spinning wheels. When he got his balance, he managed to say, "I take it you are Mrs. Sillitoe, madam?"
She nodded.
"Yes, I am, Commander," she said, as the little girl clung more tightly to her. "I know my husband is still alive, because so are we at the moment."
She stopped, as another surge lifted the entire boat. Then the Fanny came down with a splash and a spine-numbing thump, followed by the long, drawn-out bellow of a bullock who had had enough, and the start of a scream.
Vimes, Feeney, and Brass Band picked themselves up off the floor. Mrs. Sillitoe and her daughter were, amazingly, still vertical, and Mrs. Sillitoe wore a grim smile.
"That sound you heard was one of the pirates dying, I'm extremely pleased to say. That means everyone else in the cowshed is alive. Shall I tell you why? He almost certainly didn't hop. Those lifts and drops are little slams to me. Somewhere behind us a damn slam is getting so big that bits of it are carving off, and coming all the way to us at speed, you see, raising the water level and dropping it again like a stone as they go past. And that's when you have to know enough to dance to the rhythm. Because if you don't dance to the rhythm of the slam, you'll dance with the devil soon enough. A man went down there with a crossbow when the fighting started. By the sound of it, he wasn't familiar with the dance. I expect it was 10-gallon Charlie who got him when he was on the ground, poor lamb. Charlie is the bullock wrangler, and if he hits a man once, no one will ever have to hit him again."
Mrs. Sillitoe said that in a matter-of-fact, satisfied voice. "If you want to try to steal from our riverboat, you have to be prepared for some considerable inconvenience."
"And I thought the city was on the tough side," Vimes thought. He noticed that a prudent Feeney had rearmed the confiscated crossbow and said, "I'm going below to make certain. Mrs. Sillitoe, how many other pirates do you think there are?"
"There were four that came aboard as owners of the cargo." She began to tick them off on her fingers. "Mr. Harrison, the loadmaster, got one of them, but another one stabbed him, the devil. I know only one of them went down to the cowshed, and the other one helped this simpering little bastard rig up the ropes, so that if anybody was left to try any funny business, we were a hostage. And then that other man went up to the wheelhouse. I was told that we would be all right, providing my husband gets the cargo to Quem."
The little girl clung to her dress as the woman continued, her face wooden.
"Personally, I don't believe it, but he hasn't harmed my husband yet. He's counting, all the time he's counting. My husband is listening to old treachery and remembering, trying to outthink 60 miles of murderous water. And if he dies, it wins wherever you are.
Feeney, keep your crossbow pointing at this gentleman, will you?" said Vimes. "And if he makes any movement whatsoever, up to and including trying to blow his nose, you have my full authority to shoot him somewhere where it will be seriously inconvenient."
He headed to the steps and nodded to Feeney and Mrs. Sillitoe, raised a finger and said, "Be with you in just 1 minute," and hurried down into the hot and noisome heart of the wonderful Fanny. Snooker, Vimes thought, knocking the balls until you have the right one right on cue. He felt pressure on his feet surge as the vessel lifted, and instantly jumped into the air, landing neatly as the Fanny slapped back down into the water. He was confronted by a man who would surely make even Willikins think twice.
"You'd be 10 gallons. Mrs. Sillitoe sent me down here. I'm Commander Vimes, Ankh-Morpork City Watch."
And the man, with a face like a troll and a body to match, said,
"Heard about you. Thought you were dead."
"I generally look like this at the end of boat trips, Mr. Gallons," said Vimes. Then, pointing to an apparent corpse on the floor between them, "What happened to him?"
"I think he is dead," 10 Gallons leered. "I've never seen a man suffocated by his own nose before."
It was hard to hear anything down in the cowshed, given the complaining of the oxen and the ominous whirring of overstressed gears, but Vimes shouted, "Do you have a crossbow?" 10 gallons nodded, and fingers thicker than Vimes's wrist unhooked said weapon off a nail on the wall.
"Would come with you, mister, but it's all the three of us can do to hold things together down here," he spat. "Ain't really any hope anyway. The damn slam is right behind us. See you on the other side, copper."
Vimes nodded at him, examined the crossbow for a moment, made a little adjustment, and, satisfied, climbed back up the steps. Vimes looked at the few people left on the Wonderful Fanny who weren't pouring water on the backs of steaming oxen or trying to hold the boat in one piece and above water. The shocks were indeed getting closer together, he was sure of it, and surely, once there was a big enough hole, the whole damn dam would give way. All the occupants of the cabin, except Brassbound, who fell over, jumped together as yet another surge raised the boat. There was a sharp intake of breath from Feeney as Vimes went over to the trembling Brassbound, who had clearly realised that he was likely to be the unlucky winner of the first over-the-side contest. And Feeney actually groaned when Vimes handed the man the recovered crossbow, saying, "I told you, Chief Constable, I know a killer when I see one, and I need backup, and I'm sure that our Mr. Brassbound is very eager to get himself promptly onto the good side of the law right now, a decision that might well make him look better in court. Am I not right, Mr. Brassbound?" The young man nodded fervently. Vimes added, "I'd rather have you down here, Feeney. Until I know exactly who is still on this tub, I'd like you to look after the ladies. Right now, I'm not sure I know who's alive and who's dead." "The Fanny is not a tub, Commander," said Mrs. Sillitoe sharply, "but I'll forgive you this one time." Vimes gave her a little salute, as all but Brassbound jumped, and once again the idiot floundered. Vimes turned towards the stairs. "It's going to be Stratford up there with the pilot, isn't it, Mr. Brassbound?" Another, bigger surge this time, and Brassbound landed heavily. He managed to get out.
"And he's heard about you. You know how it is, and he's determined to get down to the sea before you catch up with him. He's a killer, sir, a stone killer. Don't give him a chance, sir. I beg you for all our sakes, and do it quickly for yours."
The air was electric, truly electric. Everything metal shook and jangled.
"They say the dam is going to break pretty soon," said Brassbound.
"Thank you for that, Mr. Brassbound. You sound like a sensible young man to me, and I'll say so to the authorities." The worried young man's face was wreathed in smiles as he said,
"And you're the famous Commander Vimes, sir. I'm glad to be at your back."
There were a lot of steps up to the wheelhouse. The pilot was king and rode high over the river, monarch of all he surveyed, even if, as now, rain hammered at the expensive glass windows as if it found such solid slabs of sky offensive. Vimes stepped inside quickly. It was hardly worth shouting, given that the storm drowned out everything, but you had to be able to say that you'd said it. "Commander Vimes, Ankh-Morpork City Watch. Statute of Necessary Action," which didn't exist, but he swore to himself that he would damn well get it enacted as soon as he got back, even if he had to call in favours from all over the world. A lawman faced with a dreadful emergency should at least have some kind of fig leaf to shove down the throats of the lawyers. He could see the back of Mr. Sillitoe's head with his pilot's cap. The pilot paid Vimes no attention, but a young man was standing looking at Vimes in knock-kneed, pant-sweating horror. The sword he had been carrying landed heavily on the deck. Brassbound was hopping from one foot to the other.
"You'd better take care of him right now, Commander. He'll have a trick or two up his sleeve and no mistake."
Vimes ignored this and carefully patted the young man down, freeing up one short knife, the sort a river rat might carry. He used it to cut a length of rope and tied the man's hands together behind him. "Okay, Mr. Stratford, we're going downstairs, though if you'd like to dive into the water first, I won't stop you." And then the man spoke for the first time.
"I ain't Stratford, sir," he said, pleading. "I'm Squeezy McIntyre. That's Stratford behind you with the crossbow pointing at you, sir."
The man formerly known as Brassbound gave a chuckle as Vimes turned.
Oh, my, the great Commander Vimes. I'll be damned if you ain't as dumb as a pile of all shit. You know the eyes of a killer when you see 'em, do you? I reckon I've killed maybe, 16 people, not including goblins, of course, they don't count."
Stratford sighted on Vimes and grinned.
"Maybe it's my boyish features, would you say? What kind of bloody fool cares about the goblins, eh? Oh, they say they can talk, but you know how those little buggers can lie."
The tip of the crossbow drifted back and forwards hypnotically in Stratford's hands.
"I'm curious, though. I mean, I don't like you, and sure as salvation I'm going to shoot you, but do me a favour and tell me what you saw in my eyes, okay?"
Squeezy took the opportunity to hop desperately down the steps, just as Vimes said, with a shrug.
I saw a goblin girl being murdered. What lies did she tell you?
I know the eyes of a murderer, Mr. Stratford. Oh, surely I do, because I've looked into eyes like that many times. And if I need reminding, I look into my shaving mirror. Oh, yes, I recognise your eyes, and I'm interested to see what you're going to do next, Mr. Stratford. Though, now I come to think about it, maybe it wasn't sensible of me to give you that crossbow. Maybe I really am stupid, because I'm offering you the opportunity to surrender to me here and now, and I'm doing it only once.
Stratford stared with his mouth open and then said,
"Hell, Commander, I've got the drop on you, and you want me to surrender to you? Sorry, Commander, but I'll see you again in hell."
There was a space in the world for the crossbow to sing when the grinning Stratford pulled the trigger. Unfortunately, the sound that it made approximated to the word thunk. He stared at it.
"I took the safety pin out and stamped it into the dung," said Vimes. "You can't fire it without the pin. Now, I expect you have a couple of knives about your person, and so if you fancy cutting your way out past me, then I'll be happy to accommodate you. Although I'll tell you that, firstly, you won't succeed, and secondly, if you manage to get past a boy who grew up on the streets of Ankh-Morpork, there's a man down there with a punch that can fell an elephant. And if you knife him, you'll just make him more annoyed."
The surge this time was bigger than ever, and Vimes banged his head on the cabin's roof before coming down again in front of Stratford and kicking him smartly in the official police officer method and also the groin.
"Oh, come on, Mr. Stratford. Don't you have a reputation to keep up? Feared killer. You should spend some time in the city, my lad, and I'll make certain you do."
Stratford fell backwards, and Vimes continued, "And then you'll hang, as is right and proper. But don't worry. Mr. Trooper does a nifty noose, and they say it hardly hurts at all. Tell you what, just to get the adrenaline pumping, Mr. Stratford, imagine I'm the goblin girl. She begged for her life, Mr. Stratford, remember that? I do, and so do you. You fell down at the first surge, Mr. Stratford. River rats know what to do. You didn't, although I must say you've covered it very well. Whoops!" This was because Stratford had indeed tried his hand with a knife. Vimes twisted his wrist and flung the blade down the stairs just as the glass in the wheelhouse smashed, and a branch longer than Vimes ploughed across the room, shedding leaves and dragging torrential rain and darkness behind it. Both the lamps had gone out, and, as it turned out, so had Stratford, hopefully through a shattered window, possibly to his death, but Vimes wasn't sure. He would have preferred, definitely. But there was no time to fret about him, because now came another surge, and water poured in through the glassless windows. Vimes jerked open the little gate to the pilot's deck and found Mr. Sillitoe struggling up out of the pile of storm-washed debris. He was moaning,
"I've lost count! I've lost count!"
Vimes pulled him upwards and helped him into his big chair, where he banged on the arms in frustration.
"And now I can't see a damned thing in all this muck! Can't count, can't see, can't steer, won't survive!"
"I can see, Mr. Sillitoe," said Vimes. "What do you want me to do?"
"You can!"
Vimes stared out at the homicidal river. "There's a thundering great rock coming up on the left-hand side. Should it be doing that? Looks like there's a busted landing stage there.
Ye gods, that's Baker's Knob. Here, let me at the wheel. How close is it now?"
"Maybe 50 yards.
"And you can see it and all this? Damn me, mister. You must have been born in a cave. That means we ain't that far from Quirm now. A touch under 19 miles. You think you could stand lookout? Is my family okay? That little snot threatened to harm them if I didn't keep the fanny on schedule."
Something big and heavy bounced off the roof and spun away into the night, and the pilot went on.
"Gastwick Sillitoe, delighted to make your acquaintance, sir."
He stared ahead.
"I've heard of you. Coombe Valley, right. Happy to have you aboard."
"Gastwick? Whole tree spinning in current near left-hand shore, 10 yards ahead. Nothing much to see on right." The wheels spun frantically again.
"Obliged to you, sir, and I surely hope you won't take it amiss if I say that we generally talk about port and starboard."
"Wouldn't know about that, Gastric. Never drank starboard.
Massive what looks like smashed logs ahead 40 yards, looks like small stuff. And I see a faint light high up on our right, can't tell how far away."
Vimes ducked, and a jagged log bounced off the back of the wheelhouse. Beside him, the pilot sounded as if he had got a grip on things now.
"Okay, Commander, that would be Jackson's light. Very welcome sight. Now I've found my bearings and an hourglass that ain't busted, I'll be further in your debt if you go below and tell 10 gallons to cut loose the barges. There's a chicken farmer on one of them, best to get him on board before the dam breaks. And hundreds of goblins, Gastric." "Pay them no mind, sir, goblins is just goblins."
For a moment Vimes stared into the darkness, and the darkness within the darkness, and it said to him, "You're having fun, aren't you, Commander? This is Sam Vimes being Sam Vimes in the dark and the rain and the danger, and because you're a copper, you're not going to believe that Stratford is dead until you see the corpse. You know it. Some people take a devil of a lot of killing. You know you saw him go out of the cabin, but there's all kinds of ropes and handholds on the boat, and the bugger was wiry and limber. And you know, just as day follows night, that he'll be back. Double jeopardy, Commander Vimes. All the pieces on the board, goblins to save, a murderer to catch, and all the time, when you remember, there is a wife and a little boy waiting for you to come back." "I always remember." "Of course you do, Commander Vimes," the voice continued. "Of course you do. But I know you, and sometimes a shadow passes every sun. Nevertheless, the darkness will always be yours, my tenacious friend." And then reality either came back or went away, and Vimes was saying, "We bring the goblins aboard, Gastric, because they... yes, they are evidence in an important police investigation." There was a further surge, and this time Vimes landed up on the deck, which was a little bit softer now because of the ragged carpet of leaves and branches. As he got up, Mr. Sillitoe said, "Police investigation, you see. Well, the Fanny has always been a friend of the law, but, well, sir, they stink like the pits of hell, and that's the truth of it. They'll frighten the oxen something terrible." "Do you think they aren't frightened already?" said Vimes. "A small log jam ahead on the right, all clear on the left." He sniffed. "Trust me, sir, by the smell of it, they're pretty nervous as it is. Can't you just stop and tie us up to the bank?" Sillitoe's laugh was brittle. "Sir, there are no banks now, none that I've tried to get to. I know this river, and it's angry, and there's a damn slam coming. Can't stop it any more than I could stop the storm. You signed up for the long haul, Commander. Either we race the river, or we fold our hands, pray to the gods, and die right now." He saluted. "Nevertheless, I can see you're a man, sir, who does what he sees needs doing, and by hokey, I can't argue with that. You've done a man's job as it is, Commander Vimes, and may the gods go with you. May they go with all of us." Vimes ran down the steps, grabbing Feeney in passing, and danced over the heaving floor to the cowshed. "Come on, lad, it's time to ditch the barges. There's too much of a drag. Mr. Ten-Gallons, let's get the doors open, shall we? Mr. Sillitoe has put me in charge down here. If you want to argue, feel free." The huge man didn't even attempt an argument and punched the doors open. Vimes swore. Mr. Sillitoe had been right. There was roaring not far behind them, and a river of lightning and blue fire was sweeping down the valley like a tide. For a moment he was hypnotized, and then got a grip. "Okay, Feeney, you start getting the goblins on board, and I'll fetch our chicken farmer. The bloody iron ore can sink for all I care." In the glaring light of the dam slam, Vimes jumped twice to land on the barge, from which was already coming the squawking of terrified birds. Water poured off him as he dragged open the hatch and shouted, "Mr. False! No, don't start grabbing the chickens. Better off farmer with no chickens than a load of chickens with no farmer. Anyway, they'll probably float, or fly, or something." He coaxed the frightened man onto the next barge to find that it was still full of bewildered goblins. Feeney was looking out from the open door at the rear of the Fanny, and above the roar and hissing, Vimes heard him shout, "It's Mr. Ten-Gallon, sir! He says no goblins!" Vimes glanced behind them and then turned back to Feeney. "Very well, Mr. Feeney, keep an eye on the goblins' barge while I discuss matters with Mr. Ten-Gallons, understand?" He flung Mr. False onto the deck of the Fanny and looked around for Ten-Gallons. He shook his head. What a copper that man would make if properly led by human beings. He sighed. "Mr. Ten-Gallons, I told you Mr. Sillitoe has given me carte blanche. Can we discuss the matter of the goblins?" The giant growled. "I ain't got no carte, and I don't know no blanche. And I ain't having no goblins on my deck, okay?" Vimes nodded, poker-faced, and looked exhaustedly at the deck. "Is that your last word, Mr. Ten-Gallons?"
"It damn well is."
"Okay, this is mine." Ten-Gallons went over backwards like a tree and began to sleep like a log. The street never leaves you. And what the University of the Street told you was that fighting was a science, the science of getting the opponent out of your face and face down on the ground, with the maximum amount of speed and the minimum of effort. After that, of course, you had a range of delightful possibilities and the leisure in which to consider them. But if you wanted to fight fair, or at least more fair than most of the other street options, then you had to know how to punch, and what to punch, and from precisely which angle to punch it. Of course, His treasured brass knuckles were an optional but helpful extra, but, Vimes thought as he tried to wring some blood back into his fingers, probably any court after sight of 10 gallons would have forgiven Vimes even if he used a sledgehammer. He looked at the brass knuckles. They hadn't even bent. Good old Ankh-Morpork know-how. The country may have the muscle, but the city has got the technology, he thought, as he slipped them back in his pocket. OK, Mr. Feeney, let's get them in, shall we? Find Stinky, he's the brains of the outfit.